Someone once said that to understand the book of Revelation, you need to understand Revelation 12. Someone also said to understand Revelation 12, you need to understand the book of Revelation. Obviously, Revelation is much interlinked. Obviously, there are many lessons we can gain from many chapters. And for this afternoon, we're going to be looking at Revelation 12, the dragon. And, of course, we're going to be dealing with this dragon, and I believe Brother Rick will undoubtedly delve into the appearance of the dragon in other places as well in Revelation. And we trust that this will be an opportunity for us to find out how these things link together and clarify in our minds what the Lord's Word says on these subjects. We're encouraged by His having taken this assignment, and we now give him to you and trust that you will take this opportunity to listen and apply these thoughts in your personal studies and hearts. Brother Rick.
Well, good afternoon, brethren. I'd like to return thanks unto the Heavenly Father for the opportunity of being here with you, and we'd like to thank the New Brunswick Ecclesia for giving us this privilege of sharing some thoughts with you. We'd also like to bring the love and greetings of the Oakland County Bible students with whom we meet. And we rejoice that so many of us actually happen to be here and been drinking in the blessings of convention. Revelation 12, the dragon. Well, we'd like to start by looking at Revelation 12. And we might take one approach. There could be a number of approaches, but the one approach we might take is to start by considering the 12th chapter almost as it were as a drama of itself with certain players or actors or characters that we might consider. So what I'd like to do at first is to consider some of these actors, as it were, and in a little bit of detail, and then go back and consider the chapter verse by verse. In the 12th chapter, verse 1, we read that there appeared a great wonder, or in the Greek, there appeared a great sign in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, and upon a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. The heavens would represent the ecclesiastical or religious realm. The woman, we believe, would represent the early church, and I might even suggest we could be as definitive as saying the Spirit begotten. Clothed with the sun would mean that the church has as its garb the gospel message, which is centered in the writings of the New Testament of Jesus and his 12 apostles. Jesus is associated with the sun on numerous occasions, and so clothed with the sun is a light source. Jesus brought to light life and immortality. So the New Testament explains and clarifies and elaborates for us so many of the types and shadows and prophecies of the Old Testament, pictured here as the moon under her feet, which is a reflective light, a lesser light than the sun, but important as the law, the prophets, and the prophecies and the testimony in the Old Testament gives support to us, the church. Upon her head was a crown of 12 stars. The crown shows authority, and the 12 stars themselves, a star, is a light source. So the 12 apostles of the Lamb, as recorded in Revelation, the 21st chapter, are the crowning authority in the church after God and Jesus. Jesus is associated with the sun here, which in our heavens is the brightest, while the stars are luminaries at night, because of their distance from us, they are lesser lights. Now, we would also suggest here that this woman first appeared in the heaven in AD 33 at Pentecost. Now, we'd like to read in verse 3, and there appeared another wonder in heaven. In other words, at the same time that you see this woman, there is another wonder in the religious or ecclesiastical realm. It was a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon the head. This dragon was concurrent with the woman. The dragon itself represents the civil power of the Roman Empire. We are looking at it at a point in time when it is changing from pagan Roman Empire to the first throes and developments of the so-called Christian Roman Empire. It is a time when we would have Emperor Constantine on the pages of history. This would demonstrate to us the time setting for our 12th chapter begins with the earliest stages of the Gospel Age. That is the point in time in which we are interested in the Roman Empire. It had existed much longer previously, but it's now when it comes in contact with Christianity that we are interested here in this prophecy of the 12th chapter. Great Red Dragon, there is a very interesting identification, why the red, with the Roman Empire. Now, Bishop Hyslop, in his works, The Two Babylons, on page 238, he brings out that the imperial standard of Rome, especially the emperor's status as Pontifex Maximus, which really it's the chief or head of the religion in Rome. But the word Pontifex Maximus has the thought of bridge builder, as if one who could span the space between heaven and earth, between man and the gods. Pontifex Maximus, bridge builder. Well, Hyslop brings out that the standard of Rome, particularly as well of the emperors, was a great fiery red serpent. And the dragon here does seem to contain the thought of a serpent-like creature. So we think this is a identifier for us to the Roman Empire. Now we notice, obviously, the dragon has 7 heads. And we will suggest that the 7 heads are 7 successive types of government during the Gospel Age of the Roman Empire. The 10 horns are 10 basic divisions of power within that Roman Empire. The 7 crowns that we see upon the heads also represent authority, as a crown represents authority. And when the crowns are positioned on the head, it would suggest that the leading authority of the empire in our time setting centers in the civil authority. Now, I'd like to put it maybe in a very simple way, what we've just stated. Take me, for example. I have a body. Well, this dragon has a body. The body is the people of the Roman Empire. The people are really the support. It's the majority. But I need a head. The body needs a head. The head is the form of government that controls the body. The body is the people of the empire. The head is the government. It gives direction to the empire, to the body. On the head are these 10 horns. And if you look at a bull, if you looked at a rhinoceros, if you looked at any number of your animals that you think of with horns, like the goat or the rams in Daniel, the horns are on the heads. And it is a power of that animal to fight with. As we know, the Grecian goat ramming the Persian ram and bringing it low with this horn it had. So the government, the head, gives direction to the horns, the diverse powers within the scope of the empire. During the Gospel Age, there were many times when there was one emperor of the empire, and there were various kings underneath that emperor's authority. There would be an emperor, king of the empire, then there would be lesser kings. This would represent the distinction between the head and the horns. Another aspect that we would like to demonstrate is that the heads are successive, one after the other, one at a time, though, while the ten horns are concurrent. And we'd like to turn to Revelation, the 17th chapter, for our proof of this. As Bible students, we say this a lot, but I'm not sure how many of us have demonstrated from Scriptures why we say it. I think in the 17th chapter we can illustrate this. The 17th chapter, in verse 10, it tells us let me back up just a little bit to tell you why we're saying this. In verse 7, Revelation 17, verse 7, the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, which has seven heads and ten horns. Now, this is a beast, but we notice it has the identifying factors of having seven heads and ten horns. Please make note that whenever you read this, seven heads and ten horns, whether it's on the dragon, the great red dragon, or the beast, it's an identifier that we're talking about the Roman Empire at some point in time during the Gospel Age. That's our identifier. It's a trademark, if you will. But now we've identified this is what we're talking about. Now look with me to verse 10, and it tells us there are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. So you have five, one is, and another is not yet come. That's your seven heads. But you notice that they're not all on the scene at the same time. They're successive. We think this verse demonstrates that to us. But now, glance down to verse 12. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. And these have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. We're just using this right now to demonstrate that all ten horns are considered to be concurrent at the same time, because this verse demonstrates that they are of one mind, these ten divisions of power in the empire, to cooperate for this 1 hour to give their power unto the beast. So I think we've demonstrated the heads are successive, one after the other, but the horns are considered to be concurrent all at the same time. Now, what we'd like to do is to take a look in verse 9 of the 17th chapter while we're here. And it tells us that here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And historically, this is recognized as being the seven hills upon which the city of Rome is situated. This is a historical identifier that even almost, as it were, the layperson could identify with Rome. So the seven heads are given a double application, which is very unique. Very unique. Verse 9, it tells us the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And then in verse 10, it tells us, and there are seven kings, which we read, five are fallen, one is yet to come. So first we learn that these seven heads are seven mountains. Then we learn that they are also seven kings. So, in the one hand, these seven mountains suggest the seven hills of Rome, literally, but on the other hand, as a mountain represents a kingdom, so the seven heads are seven kings or governments that have ruled over the Roman Empire. So it helps us solidify our understanding that we are considering the Roman Empire in some aspect whenever we see seven heads and ten horns mentioned. Now, I'd like to bring out a point of observation here. Our first two characters in this 12th chapter, the woman and then this dragon, you notice that each are mentioned with having a head. One has the woman has one head upon which are a crown of 12 stars. But we notice that this dragon had seven heads with crowns upon these seven heads. What we would like to suggest is that the woman only has one head, and that is Christ Jesus. And it only has the one crown of the 12 apostles as their authority. That never changes throughout the gospel age. The development of the Christian church is demonstrated in Revelation in chapters 2 and 3 by the seven different churches of Asia, one after another. And that shows the development of the Christian church, but the Christian church only had one true head and only the one crown of the 12 apostles as their guiding light throughout that time. But with the Roman Empire, we're watching the development and changes of the Roman Empire during the same gospel age, but its forms of government, its leadership has changed seven times. And it has a variety of these horns. Sometimes they have authority, and sometimes the authority does not reside with them. So we thought it was an interesting comparison between the two. Now, in Revelation, the 13th chapter, we'd like to look at verse 1. And it tells us that as I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his head the names of blasphemy, that we observe that here again we're observing the Roman Empire, but now it's not a great red dragon. Now it's pictured as a beast. The great red dragon, as we stated earlier, was the civil authority of the Roman Empire as it was changing from pagan to so-called Christian. Here, this beast, we think, represents the papacy as it was in control, as one of these seven heads over the Roman Empire. So it has the identifier of the seven heads and ten horns. But what we note here is the difference in the placement of the crowns. The crowns here are no longer on the heads as in the 12th chapter on the great red dragon. Here the crowns are upon the horns. And we think this also helps us to understand that when the crowns are on the head in the 12th chapter with the dragon, it is showing us that the supreme authority, the form of government over the Roman Empire, is situated with the civil power, the emperor. But here, with this beast, being the papacy, under the papal head, or form of government, over the Roman Empire, the authority really resides with the papacy in that head, but the authority of civil power is resting upon these lesser kings that are under papacy's authority. It makes this distinction for us. So an ecclesiastical power is chiefly in control of the empire in Revelation 13:1 beast. Now back to the 12th chapter. We notice that in verse 4, that our next players are the stars of heaven. And in the stars of heaven, we again have a similarity to the 12 stars in the woman's crown. Except here, these 12 stars, the 12 stars were the apostles as true light bearers to the church. So this third part of the stars would represent light bearers in, after a fashion to the church in a specific period of time. These would be religious leaders in the church, specifically certain of the bishops to the church and their authority to give light to the church in a proper way. We're going to come back to this when we go through this verse by verse. The next character we would take a look at is the man-child in verse 5. This is, when we say the man-child, we might almost say it's the boy of sin. We have our man of sin that we're familiar with in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. Well, this is him in his earliest development. After he appears on the scene, he is a man-child. But this represents the papacy. And it represents the growth and the development of the papacy and the apostate church. It tells us in verse 5 that he was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. So this shows that in the future there would be this man-child would grow up to be the man of sin who would have authority over the Roman Empire. But just here is the crux of the matter. So many of our Christian friends have misunderstood this prophecy of the 12th chapter because they view this man-child really as representing Christ Jesus and his literal birth as a human. But these phrases that he was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, while it is applicable to Jesus and the church in glory, and that he would be caught up to the throne of God as part of Jesus' heavenly reward and his authority, these are counterfeited by the papacy, the man of sin. And unless one understands this, then the rest of the chapter just is taken literally and leads one to great confusion. As soon as you recognize that this is talking about the counterfeit, then all becomes harmonious, verse by verse, and we'll talk about that more. Further along, we have the characters in the 7th chapter of Michael and his angels. Again, one might think of the archangel Michael, but actually this too is the counterfeit. Michael means who as God. So who sits as God in the counterfeit, but again, the popes as the leaders of the papacy? They present themselves as God's representatives, and even some have claimed to be as God in some of their preposterous statements. His angels, his messengers, would be the clergy class, the bishops, the cardinals, the priests, all those that would support him. And they take to themselves proper titles and that are truly meant to be reserved for Christ and his church. Now we also have, in the same verse 7, the dragon and his messengers. Now the dragon would represent the civil authority. This would particularly seated in the emperor of the empire. And then his angel or his messengers are the various offices of lesser kings, princes, nobles, counts, magistrates, etc. These are the two sides of the conflict. In verse 9, we're introduced to a great dragon. And we think this dragon represents civil authority. It tells us that this is that old serpent, which is a reference to Eden, the old serpent. Where do we remember seeing the serpent? In the Garden of Eden. That old serpent, this historic enemy to that which is good and right. And what was that serpent noted for but for deceptive lies? Satan himself is that old serpent. For Jesus said that Satan was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. The devil means false accuser, falsely accusing the true church, falsely accusing Jesus as a blasphemer of God and various other profanities against our Lord at the first advent. False accuser even against God himself, all the way back in the garden. He falsely accused God of not having Adam and Eve's best intention and heart. Satan means adversary. And certainly Satan is the adversary not only of God, but all things good and those who are for the good. So the great dragon, that old serpent, the devil and Satan, while they can represent different aspects in which Satan is active and working in the earth to accomplish his will, they point back unmistakably to Satan as being the God of this world. And these are the systems by which he tries to work his will. But they identify for us Satan. Please note with me now in verses 12 to 16 the use of dragon, serpent, and devil, how they are used interchangeably. In verse 12, we read partway through, "For the devil has come down unto you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath a short time." Verse 13. "And when the dragon saw he was cast to the earth..." Now see, first we just heard that it was the devil come down. But really, in the next verse it tells us in 13 that when the dragon saw he was cast to the earth. So we're using devil and we're using dragon. We think we're talking about the same. It's Satan's first attempt at power in this gospel age through the civil authority of the Roman Empire, losing its power and him having now to counterfeit with the true church with his papal intrigues. He's had a change of tactic. It calls it the devil, and then it calls it the dragon. We think it's trying to tell us that we should look behind the scenes to see that this is the machinations of Satan. But then read on. It tells us in verse 14, "The woman was given these wings." Now look at the end of the verse. "To flee from the face of the serpent." Now it's using the serpent with the devil and the dragon. Verse 15, "The serpent cast out of his mouth water to swallow up the woman." Now read verse 16, "But the earth helped the woman." And the end of the verse says that the earth swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Now it just said in verse 15, the serpent cast water out of his mouth as a flood. And here it says that the dragon cast out the flood of water out of his mouth. So the dragon was wroth. So we just think it's the way in which the Lord was pleased to give us instruction. The devil, the dragon, and the serpent. These are all references to point back to Satan behind these efforts to destroy the Christian church. There's another observation we'd like to make when considering this chapter. Twice in this chapter, Satan plays on two sides of the field. Twice in this chapter, Satan is playing two sides of the field. In the first, we have him as working through this great red dragon, and then we see him also working in this man-child, which would grow up to be the man of sin, this counterfeit Michael, and he's playing off on both sides. He's really behind both the civil authority of the Roman Empire and the rising papal influence in the Roman Empire. He's on both sides. He's playing both sides. It's because when the true church came on the scene and he tried to annihilate it with the persecution through the pagan Roman Empire, which he'd rather do, and it didn't succeed, he then had to counterfeit the true church and try to win the war against the true church by imitating her. So, like the old saying goes, if you can't beat them, join them. Here, with Satan, if you can't beat them, counterfeit them and confuse them. But as the woman was protected by being carried into the wilderness, Satan tries again to play both sides. The second time he tries to play this is that as a dragon or the serpent, as the civil power of the Roman Empire, he is also the dragon or serpent by which the flood of truth comes out of the mouth. So the flood of truth, as Brother Russell suggests, we think it's very reasonable. The water is truth, and there was a flood of it, and it was during the period of the French Revolution that there were these truths of the rights and liberties of man that were put forth very speedily and in a great quantity, particularly in France, but it did sweep over Rome. And it was an attempt by the adversary to cause such an alarm of these liberties and rights that the people of the empire would want to have some restrictions placed on these cries for liberty, both social liberty and religious liberty. And in so doing, they would ensnare the church as those who do proclaim religious liberty. So on the one hand, he's playing the dragon as a civil authority. On the other hand, he's putting forth these truths that's stirring up against the civil authority. He's playing both sides. But in the Lord's arrangement, the earth did accept these truths. The people of the empire did accept the concept of liberty and rights for the individuals. And they cast off, as it were, for a time, the civil authority and the religious authority of the papacy. So this chapter is teaching us about two times Satan has tried, working on both sides of the field, to ensnare the true church. We'd also suggest that this chapter takes us from 33 A.D., we first see this woman appear in the religious realm, down to the time of 1800 A.D., shortly thereafter. This is our period of time of the Gospel Age history we're considering. But then the last verse, the 17th verse, we do think is a reference to a time in the future. We'll get to that, we trust, and talk more about that. Now, turning back to the first part of the chapter, when we see the early church pictured in this woman, we would like to take a moment to address the point that some brethren feel this woman would represent the Sarah covenant. Our problem that we suggest with that is that the Sarah covenant did not bear this man-child. The man-child, as the papacy, would be composed of tares. Tares do not come from the Sarah covenant. A covenant itself does not flee into the wilderness. It was the pure element of the church that would flee into this wilderness for this 1260-year period. It's not the covenant itself, which is an intangible, that Satan is fighting against. Satan fights and persecutes the children of the covenant, even as Ishmael tried to persecute Isaac, as we're explained in Galatians, the fourth chapter. It's not Sarah that was persecuted by Hagar or some such. It's the children, the offspring of the covenant, that are persecuted. So we have to say for ourselves, we do not find the thought of the woman as being the Sarah covenant appealing. In fact, we think that the crowning glory of the church with the 12 apostles upon their head, they are the ones that have this gospel light supported by the law, not the covenant. Now, we read in verse 2 that this woman was pictured as being with child. The child is separate. So So this shows there is a separate entity that's associated to the church, but it's not the church. We think this is the mystery of iniquity that was already working in Paul's day. This is the spirit of the Nicolaitans, of lordship rising up. It was the spirit of those who would want to be the clergy and to lord it over their fellow brethren. This spirit was already at work in the apostles' day. So this woman had associated with her this embryo development of the man of sin. Now, how long is the duration of a pregnancy? If you look in a dictionary under pregnancy or gestation, they'll tell you it is 280 days that they use for the calculation. But they'll tell you that only 1 in 10 babies are actually born after exactly 280 days. But that's the calculation they use. So too here, we think that 280 years, you can it's divisible by 7 times 40. Perfect period of trial. 7 times 40 equals 280. And if you take it from 33 A.D. at Pentecost, where we would first see this woman, it would bring you down to 313 A.D. That is just our time when we think we have our setting of our picture with this dragon. In 303 to 313 is a 10-year period of Revelation, the second chapter, verse 10, of the 10 days in prison, or the 10 years in prison. This would be the infamous period of the persecution of Diocletian, the Roman emperor, followed upon by Galerius, his successor. It was this 10-year period, but it ended in 313, the end of our 280-year period of this supposed pregnancy. In the date 312, Constantine adopts Christianity in name. In 312, Constantine becomes the master of the Roman Empire of the West. So now you have a Christian, so-called Christian, Roman Emperor of the West in 312. Just about this time we're looking for it. It's the end of this most fierce, or one of the most fierce persecutions of Christianity by pagan Rome, now being displaced by so-called Christian emperor. And in 313, we have the Edict of Milan, which basically gave religious toleration to Christians in the Roman Empire after this fierce period of persecution. Now, also about this time, in 318, now just a few years later, 318, our Arius, our beloved Arius, stated his doctrine that Christ was created and that God the Father was eternal, so that Christ is separate and distinct and inferior to the Father. This was his public proclamation, in a sense, in 318. By 324, and we're not talking much time there, are we? 324, Constantine becomes emperor of the eastern part of the Roman Empire as well as the western. So now he's the emperor of the entire Roman Empire. And in 325, the very next year, Constantine calls for this World Council of Bishops to form an Orthodox belief regarding the identity of God the Father and Jesus the Son. And his purpose in that council, which is known as the Council of Nicaea, was to try to unify his empire. He wanted to pull the Christians together, which was his support group. He wasn't really concerned about the religious question as much as the political implications. So, previous to this 313, we go from state persecution to after 313 to state toleration, and the emperor now being Christian. So, from 312 to 325, we have a 13-year period. What a fantastic change took place. This is the setting for the birth of this man-child, this apostate church. We would just suggest that one can track this development of the apostate church through the early stages of the church as mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3, by following the Lord's comments to the first, second, third, fourth stage of the church regarding the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. First stage of the church, we're told that the Lord praised that Ephesus stage because they didn't tolerate the spirit of the Nicolaitans, this clergy-like attitude. The second stage of the church, we don't hear anything about the Nicolaitans because they were being persecuted by the pagans. That wasn't the focus. But in the third stage of the church, which is our time setting with Arius on the scene, our time setting of Constantine, by this time we're told in the third stage of the church that they have the spirit of the Nicolaitans rise up in their midst. So it helps us to identify our timing here in the development of the Christian church with those earlier stages of the church. In verse 4, we read that this dragon had a tail. And the tail, we think, would represent the power of this empire in a sense. I've never wrestled alligators, but I've read about those who supposedly wrestle alligators, and they say you've got to watch out for the tail, because the tail is so powerful that as it thrashes about, it could crush a leg or break an arm, break a back. So you have to watch its tail. So here, instead of trying to show a dragon, which usually is depicted with having very short forearms, it's got to stand on its hind legs, or if it's hunched over, it's holding itself up. It doesn't use its arms the way we might. It uses its tail to sweep down a third part of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. We like the suggestion, and we find it from McClintock's and Strong's, that there were three divisions of bishops that had been gathered to this Council of Nicaea in 325. A part was Trinitarian, a part was what is known as Sabellian, and the other part was Arian, those who followed Arius's doctrinal views. Now, I would suggest that the only true light bearers there would have been the Arian contingent or part. But by the end of the council, when the vote transpired, only about two or three of these originally Arian bishops voted with Arius. The majority, or the rest of that third part of these stars who began as Arians, capitulated at the council. So they were removed as true light bearers to the church and were brought down to an earthly level of reasoning. They compromised. So the dragon was successful in bringing about an enforced seeming unity of orthodoxy with the Trinitarian view winning that day. This we would consider to be very similar to in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, verse 7, where it tells us that this man of sin would be developed in the future, but there was a hindrance standing in the way who was restraining the development of the man of sin. That would be the Roman Empire. We're considered the religious leaders of the empire as well. And now, with Constantine adopting Christianity, that hindrance was beginning to be removed. Now it was much more reasonable to think that with Christianity as the empire's religion, the emperor being Christian, the edict of toleration, the end of the persecution, the bishops were invited to the seat of the empire, as it were, in this council, that now that hindrance which had stood in their way was now removed, and this clergy class could more clearly see a way in which they could reach the seat of the empire. So we think there's this connection here. Now in verse 5, it tells us that when this man-child was brought forth, it was to rule all nations. We think that is a reference to the future when it says was. It was to rule in the future, not as the man-child, but as the man of sin when it comes to maturity. That would be a reference from 799 to 1799, what we call the papal millennium or the counterfeit of Christ's true millennium. That would be the period we might denote as the Holy Roman Empire, when the Pope first crowned Charlemagne as head of the Roman Empire, the Pope being the bestower of the crown, showing that he was the superior to the one on whom he bestowed the crown. He ruled at the Pope's goodwill, was the intention there. So that would be our 799, or if you like, our 800 to 1799 period. That's when he would rule with this rod of iron. So it's telling us about the future history of this man-child, when it would be born. Now it tells it to be caught up unto God and unto his throne, again a reference to 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, that this man of sin would appear in the temple of God, in the spiritual church. They would present itself, and that's what the Pope did, presented itself who as God, as it were, and that was in these popes. Okay, in verse 6, it tells us the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared to God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. We think this would be a reference to our 539 to 1799. This would be our 1,260-year period that we're familiar with from Daniel, the 12th chapter, and even elsewhere here in Revelation. The woman fled into that wilderness. So that it's the Spirit begotten. It would be the true church that would flee into the wilderness, because when the man-child grows up and comes into power, it would persecute, as it were, the true church. That's the tactic Satan would take to try to persecute the true church. So they would flee into this wilderness, and God had foreseen this and prepared that they would be nourished for this period of time. We would suggest that these verses and the verses to follow are not sequential in the sense of each year unfolding sequentially, but rather we would suggest that these verses and the verses to follow are not sequential in the sense of each year unfolding sequentially, but rather the verses cannot be written in such a way as to just tell you exactly point by point as they chronologically expired. But we do think they're written in such a way as to tell us that during a certain period of time, these are the events that would take place, and there are other indicators on how we can sort them out exactly. And we'll give us an example of that as we move through here, but we think that's why in the fifth verse we can have this phrase, was to rule, pointing to 800 to 1799 period of time. And then in verse 6, it seems like we're going back and we're starting it in 539. It's telling us about the series of events that would take place during this period of time. Now in verse 7, I guess I should say another note here. The woman who fled into this wilderness, for this 1,203 score days, it would demonstrate to us that the church was protected by God from the attacks of Satan through the church and through the civil authorities. There's an important point to make here. When we say protected, that does not mean she was always physically protected. Physically, the church suffered greatly during this period of time that she was in the wilderness because she was not part of the city convention. We have very many faithful martyrs during that period of time. How was she then protected? Spiritually, the Lord provided for the Christian church during this time, that they could still, if they were faithful, they could make their calling election sure, and their eternal interests would not be lost. But they physically suffered greatly. There was an aspect with Elijah where he too, of course, fled into the wilderness for his 3.5 years, which we think is a picture of this same period of time. Now, he had a very difficult time in the wilderness. We're not to think that that was easy for him. But the Lord did provide his sustenance. He had this water at the brook until it dried up, and he was provided food. But yet he was in a very wilderness, difficult situation. So the church, during this wilderness experience, the saints were in a very difficult physical condition, but spiritually they were nurtured. Now, Elijah was fed by the ravens, which was an unclean bird. And old Brother King Barrett made a reference once to that, and he liked the thought that they represented the clergy. The ravens are black, and the clergy were dressed in black. And yet Babylon had been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, so they were copyists of the scriptures. So the Elijah class, the true church class, in that wilderness condition during that period of time, they would, as it were, snatch from these ravens these bits of meat, the flesh that they could eat from the scriptures and be nourished and have the water of truth to strengthen them. Unclean birds. Revelation 18, I think it's verse 2, talks about how Babylon is a cage of the unclean birds. The clergy class is contained there. But there is this way that the Lord even provided for his own during that time. Okay. So we go down to verse 7. We see that there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not, neither was there place on any more in heaven. The great dragon was cast out. That old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. We think this would denote the period of time from 325 all the way down to 800 A.D., that there was the struggles between the civil authorities and the religious authorities over who would be the top dog, as it were, in the empire. And eventually, who is it that wins but the religious authorities seated in papacy? We read in verse 10 that I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night." Now this would demonstrate that the civil authority, losing out, as it were, and becoming second to the religious authority of the Roman Empire, that the religious authority is saying, now is salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God. This is the counterfeit kingdom of God. So this is from 800 to 1799, the counterfeit of Christ's proper kingdom, the 1,000 years. It tells us the accuser of our brethren is cast out. The papists pointed to
the civil authorities and their past history as pagan Rome as being persecutors of the Christian church. So the papists use this as their justification that they should be in control of the empire so that the Christians aren't persecuted anymore by this previous pagan empire. This is their claim. This is how they reasoned. Now when we read in verse 11 that they, the religious power, overcame him, the civil authority, by the blood of the Lamb, it's that the papists claim that their authority is seated in Christ's sacrifice. But it's a false claim. And they say it's the word of their testimony, that they use the scriptures to their end to try to substantiate their right to rule. And those that love their lives not unto death. These are true martyrs. They were willing to sacrifice their lives for the truth's sake. But who claimed the use, as it were, of these martyrs but the papists? They have all their saints that they point to. They go all the way back to Peter and Paul as their authority. Well, those were true martyrs, but the papacy has used them as part of their authority of how and why they should be superior to the civil government, which had persecuted the early church. So this is their line of reasoning. This is what they have sold the people on as well. In verse 12, we're told, "Rejoice, ye heavens, and you that dwell in them." So who now rejoices? It's those in the religious realm who are seated in the power of authority, the papists. "Woe to those that dwell on the earth and the sea." In other words, woe to society, woe to those who have been of the irreligious masses. Woe to all those who are under the authority of this empire. Why is there the woe? "For the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth he hath but a short time." That wrath was particularly illustrated in the vicious and heartlessly cruel inquisitions of the Dark Ages. Poor society, how they suffered now, far worse under papacy's so-called Holy Roman Empire than they ever did under pagan Rome and under the civil authority. In verse 13, the short time would be that once we had our change from pagan Rome to so-called Christian Rome, Satan recognized that this was a whole new situation he was having to deal with. And he wasn't being very successful at it. So this chapter is relating to us these two different stratagems that Satan has tried to use to overcome the church, of course being thwarted each time by God. But this is what this is depicting. It's from his point of view of how he is trying to thwart the development of the church. Verse 13, "When the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth," when civil authority saw that they had lost a chief position of power in the empire, now they're subservient to the religious element, they were used, the civil authority was used to persecute the woman. That is, to try to persecute the true church. Satan worked through religion, but the papacy does not have an army, doesn't have a police force. Except for the Swiss Guard, they hardly count. So they have to, even though they're in control, the religious element has to work through the civil powers to persecute, which they did. And the civil powers cooperated. Now, verse 14, it tells us that, of course, now the woman was given these two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the face of the serpent. Again, our 1,260-year period. The two wings of the great eagle would be the support the Old and New Testament gave. That is not unlike the moon under the feet of the woman, the Old Testament, and clothed with the sun, the New Testament message. As it was early on, the church's support and clothing protection, even here, this is the means by which she is supported and protected during her 1,260-year period of persecution and flight into the wilderness. The wings of the eagle, I might suggest, Isaiah, the 40th chapter, verses 29 to 31. On more than one occasion, In Scripture, the eagle is used as being the means of refreshment, support, and encouragement and endurance for the people of God. In verse 15, the serpent casting out of his mouth the waters of truth, as we related, these truths regarding the liberties and rights of man along social lines and religious lines during the French Revolution, the people absorbed this message, and instead of being driven in fear back into the arms of a strong church-state government and persecuting these libertarians, and then persecuting the true church in with it, instead the people accept that we have our French Revolution, and they cast off the papacy, as it were, and persecute them, the clergy class, and the monarchy was overthrown for a period of time. We have our French Revolutionary government, and then we have Napoleon coming back on the scene and modifying the situation somewhat, but the Bible societies were open, and it was something Satan couldn't undo, and he totally had to abandon this tactic of trying to use floodwaters thereafter. In verse 17, we read, "The dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed." We read that the remnant of the seed are those which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. We think the reference here is that in the future, the remnant of her seed, this would be a reference to the final feet members of the church class. Now, we said the woman was the spirit begotten. That was our suggestion. So we would suggest that the woman here, again, picturing the spirit begotten, but amongst them, there is a remnant. It is the wise virgin class. Those of the 144,000 who are the remnant, the feet members, they truly do keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. And this is the element that the dragon is particularly upset with. He's mad at the woman, but he makes war. He tries to exterminate those final feet members of the church. So in the end, we learn in Revelation 17 that when this coalition of the beast and the kings do make war for that 1 hour with the Lamb and those who are with them called, chosen, and faithful, we are told that the Lamb does gain the victory at that point. So we end with a glorious, happy, edifying, uplifting hope of triumph of the church in the end. Those who truly do keep the commandments